Even now, it seems strange to me that I should be writing this memoir at all. With every week that passes, the whole experience takes on an air of unreality. For a moment, dark wings seem to fold about me. Then there is a flutter, and they are gone, and the air is clear, as if they had never been. My rational side tells me that it was nothing more than the work of my imagination. But then I pause, transfixed by the contradiction. I am not an imaginative man. I am an academic, a sociologist, a late 20th century man of reason, not a dreamer. My reason denies it. My reading and learning dismiss it. But I have seen things that I dare not think about when I am alone. There are sounds which, if I were to hear them again, would drive me mad. My name is Andrew MacLeod. I am 33 years old. My father's name was Callum, my mother's Margaret. I'm an only child. I was born in Lewis, the northern half of the island of Harris and Lewis in the Outer Hebrides. My father taught Gaelic in the Nicholson Institute in Stornoway, although he was originally a mainlander from Inverness. My upbringing was marked by a curious blend of my father's scepticism and my mother's simple faith. As a child, I went with her to church every Sunday. But by the time I was 15, I had joined my father in his unfaith. At Aberdeen University, I studied sociology and politics. By my fourth year, I had developed a particular interest in the sociology of religion. This led quite naturally to my PhD, on which I spent another 4 years, this time in Glasgow. My subject was the social location of converts to the Unification Church, the Moonies, in Scotland. I met Katrina in my second year in Glasgow, a chance meeting at a party in a friend's flat. She was a musician, a violinist with a chamber music consort. I knew within minutes of seeing her, we both knew, that nothing would ever be the same again, that all had changed in a matter of moments. I had never fallen in love before. It was as though I had stepped breathless into a world I did not recognize. We lived together for 4 years, Katrina and I. I was happier than most men ever are, and I believe she was happy as well. There is no need for detail. Our lives were perfectly ordinary. All you need to know can be summed up in a single sentence. Katrina died at the age of 26, died of cancer, died at 3 in the morning, while I was asleep. There was nothing left for me in Glasgow. No street that did not bear Katrina's mark, no landmark that did not remind me of her. I returned home for several months. While I was there, my father saw a research post in sociology advertised in the Times Educational Supplement. I put it away at first, thinking it too early to return to my old life. But I could not go back to Glasgow, and I knew I could not face the long winter on Lewis. I applied for the job and was interviewed that August. In September, I arrived in Edinburgh with a small suitcase and a bag of books. Finding accommodation proved difficult, and I spent my first 2 weeks in Edinburgh with a friend of the family, Dr. Ramsay MacLean. He helped me find my feet in the city, introducing me to people in the university where he worked in the health centre, and providing me with bearings. Towards the end of that first fortnight, he told me that he had found an excellent flat for me in the Royal Mile. I moved in 2 days later. In the meantime, I had been settling in at work. My head of department was James Ferguson, Professor of Anthropology. We met the day after my arrival at his office in Buccleuch Place. He soon made it clear to me that my appointment had been made against his wishes. Some of the theologians at New College, however, had expressed a wish for some hard information about the city's reputedly numerous occult and magical groups. There was a fear of Satanism in the air, a mood of unease. I started work the following week, reading from early morning on into the evening at the National Library. So began a tedious drift into winter, each day marked out by a succession of books and pamphlets of mind-numbing banality. I wanted to familiarize myself with a broad range of New Age and occult beliefs in order to narrow down my field of inquiry. I read until my eyes ached about the Great Pyramid, UFOs, ley lines, reincarnation, astrology, tantric yoga, crystal healing, a maze of theories that seemed to cover every imaginable human obsession, every hope and fear. By the end of December, I persuaded myself that I had read as much as I needed. I now made my first contact with some of the city's esoteric groups, restricting myself to the more popular and mainstream among them. So it was that most evenings found me in damp, ill-heated rooms or rented halls, listening to talks on Atlantis, the Himalayan masters, hermetic lore or alchemy. But I remained still largely ignorant of the world I hoped to penetrate. I understood nothing then. I was still a child. Spring passed, and summer. I had no time for anything but work. I did, however, make a couple of friends. In late August, I started a series of seminars for staff and postgraduate students at New College, the Church of Scotland Seminary. They were organized by a young lecturer called Ian Gillespie. I quickly found him to be open-minded and genuinely interested in my research. He took me home for dinner several times and introduced me to his wife, Harriet, a schoolteacher. As I had expected, they were both regular churchgoers, but I found them disinclined to preach or question. I made my own agnosticism clear to Harriet early on, and that was almost the last that was ever said on the subject. In September, I started to spend an increasing amount of time with one occult group in particular, the Fraternity of the Old Path. They owned a house in Ainslie Place, a delightful oval of Georgian dwellings in the new town. They held a set of doctrines centred round the belief that the true knowledge had been lost after the fall of Rome, and that Gnosis could only be obtained today through the performance of elaborate rituals loosely based on what was known of the ancient Greek and Egyptian mysteries. They permitted me to attend many of their ceremonies which, in all honesty, I found to be no more than ragged pantomimes, based on a limited familiarity with the rites they sought to imitate. Yet there was a terrible seriousness in their voices, and an assumed dignity in their long-rehearsed movements that transcended all the tawdriness and inarticulate striving after grace. There was another attraction for me in the Fraternity of the Old Path, their extensive library of books on the occult. The fraternity's librarian, a white-haired Pole called Jurczyk, agreed to let me have free access to any books that might be of use to me, provided I read them on the premises. He gave me a key and detailed instructions about lights, heating and locking up. I began to spend my days at Ainslie Place. Sometimes I would read from morning until late at night. No one ever disturbed me there. It was a dim, quiet room in an empty house. I had as much solitude as I wanted. It was late in November when matters began to take a more sinister turn. I arrived at the fraternity's headquarters one Friday night, later than usual. It was about 9 o'clock. Climbing the stairs in that dark building, I felt myself unusually apprehensive of the silent rooms all round me. But my work went better than I had hoped, and I became wholly absorbed in it, shutting out all impressions beyond the pale circle of light that the lamp cast over the tabletop and my papers. It must have been midnight or later when I went back to the shelves for the last time. As I bent to pick up a book from the bottom shelf of a stack I had not been to before, I noticed the edge of a small volume jutting out from behind the wooden back of the bookcase. With difficulty, I succeeded in catching a firm enough grip on it to draw it out through the gap. It seemed old, older than the majority of volumes I had seen there before. Curious, I took it over to my table and sat down. The little book was bound in hard brown leather. It had no title in the spine or front cover. The flyleaf bore a faded inscription in brown ink, written in an archaic and, to me, illegible hand. I turned it and came straight away to the title page. It read as follows. Avrimetus Africanus, Calibul Colud, or Salatul Shamsilal Helal, Sive Matrix Aeternitatis, Aut Epistola Solis ad Lunum Crescentem, Cum Versione Latina, et Notis Di Conigi, and newly Englished by Nicholas Oakley, MDX CV111. It astonished me to find a book printed as early as 1598, lying here gathering dust behind some shelves, unopened and unread. The left-hand pages carried text that I guessed to be Arabic. The main text consisted of short verses, which I then took to be spells, interspersed with what appeared to be commentary on instructions. I continued reading, fascinated by the curiosity of the language and the strange oracular quality of the spells. As I turned the page towards the end, I saw a woodcut illustration. It took me about half a minute to disentangle the subject and composition of the drawing, but to this day I wish I had never done so. Printed on my mind's eye were shapes and figures of unspeakable horror. The woodcut depicted the interior of a large church, huge and vaulted, with shadows on both sides of a wide nave. Along one side were ranged several stone tombs topped with monuments. One, near the chancel end, had been opened. A great iron door swung back. On the ground lay what I took to be corpses, as though they had been dragged from their resting places and scattered in the aisle. Just visible in the opening of the tomb were several indistinct figures, stooped over the remains of the dead. They had short, stumpy bodies, naked bodies the colour of parchment, white meat, bloodless, eternally pale. They were bent over the corpses, sucking and nibbling. And one, dear God, I cannot forget this, one was turning its head to look directly at the viewer. It did not have a face exactly, and it was shrouded in a piece of rotting cloth, but I could tell that it had no eyes. It had no eyes, but I knew that it could see. I slammed the book shut, sat back, stupefied. One thing I knew with absolute certainty, and I know it now without any hint of doubt, whoever the artist was who penned that loathsome scene had not imagined it, but drawn it from life. As I sat there, glancing nervously about me, I became aware for the first time that there were noises in the room above me. Something in the quality of the sounds told me that whatever was making them, it was not human. My heart seemed to freeze as the noises moved across the room in the direction of the door that led to the second floor landing. I heard the door opening and the sound moving across a wooden floor. Terrified, I went to the door of the library. Somewhere above me, I could hear it, very soft, like seaweed on damp rocks, flapping and wriggling across the landing. As I stood listening, it reached the first step and started down the stairs.